This is the Mahabharata Podcast, Episode 90, The Final Teachings, Part 2. Last time, we skimmed through the first half of the Anasusana Parva. I presented the stories that Bhishma told as part of his teachings. It is interesting that for some reason these stories all followed on certain themes and subjects. For example, three of the stories take place around a banyan tree, and all four are concerned with those primitive tribesmen who hunt small animals and sometimes practice cannibalism. In the first story, about the cat and the mouse, the hunter is just a peripheral character, while the protagonists are the forest animals. In the third story, about the suicidal pigeons, there's a hunter and a banyan tree, but this time, the hunter is dealing with birds. I find the story quite remarkable in that the characters all find salvation by the end, but all three die in the process, all of suicide. In stark contrast to this is the fourth story, about the Brahmin Gautama and the crane. The protagonist of this story, Gautama, is an irredeemable scoundrel, and as such, he is not saved, despite the miraculous intervention by Indra and Sarabhi. Thus, in the story of the pigeons, everyone dies violently, but they are all saved, while the notorious scoundrel Gautama is brought back to life, but spiritually, he is lost. Yudhishthira next asked Bhishma to tell him all about Krishna and who he really is. He said, "I desire to hear of the indestructible one, who is the creator of all things and was created by none. He who is the source and destination of all creatures, who is known by the names Narayana, Rishikesha, Govinda, and Keshava." Bhishma said, "I'll tell you what I learned from Ramajamadagnya, who in turn learned this from the sages Narada and Vyasa." Bhishma went on to describe what I think of as the classic picture of Hindu cosmology. He said that consciousness, matter, and space were all made from Vishnu's essence. And when Vishnu had manifested this reality, he laid down to sleep. While reclining on the primordial waters, consciousness, in the form of a beautiful lotus, sprang out of his navel. From the heart of the lotus came the grandfather of all things, the god Brahma. At the same time, in the darkness, or tamas, was born a great asura named Madhu. To ensure that Brahma had the upper hand in creation, Vishnu intervened and killed the original demon, thus earning the sobriquet of Madhusudan, or the slayer of Madhu. Now free to create, Brahma, by a fiat of will, created the first seven sages, of whom Daksha was the seventh. Daksha had 23 daughters, who were married to these sages and to the gods, and they in turn gave birth to all the races of creatures. Finally, Vishnu gave birth to the human race. From his mouth came 100 Brahmins, from his arms came 100 Kshatriyas, from his thighs he created 100 Vaishyas, and from his feet came 100 Shudras. Yudhishthira's next question concerned a famous historical king named Janaka. He wanted to know how this king managed to find salvation while living as a regular king. I find this a bit confusing. There were apparently a number of kings in Mithila who were called Janaka, going all the way back to the Ramayana, where King Janaka was Rama's father-in-law. I think Bhishma may have been referring to a later one, because he told the story of a descendant of Janaka who was called Janadev. He was also king of Mithila, and he kept a large group of religious scholars to advise him on spiritual matters. We will hear later that these disputatious scholars held some controversial views. So perhaps that is why the king turned to an outsider for advice. He invited a saintly ascetic named Panchasika to expound on religion to his court. Panchasika was a student of the sage Asuri, and one of the few facts of his life that we get is that he was adopted by his guru and accepted by his wife as her son. For some reason, Panchasika lived on her breast milk for a while. It says he used to suck her breasts, and thus he was regarded as her son. This all may sound like it is about to develop into a ripping yarn, but the dispute among Janaka scholars seems to be of such a serious matter that all pretense of narrative structure breaks down. What seems to have happened was that Janadev's court was infested with Buddhists. The word Buddhism is not explicitly mentioned, but I have little doubt that it was Buddhist philosophy that caused the controversy. It says that King Janadev invited the sage Panchasika to expound on Shankya religious philosophy, which he did, conveying basically the same message we got from the Bhagavad Gita. He explained that what we consider to be reality is in fact an illusion and the source of our suffering. He discussed the nature of the delusion that keeps us attached to the things of this world, and how the things of this world could not be depended upon for happiness. His point of contention with the skeptics at the king's court was over the existence of the soul. These philosophers argued that there is nothing that survives the extinction of the body. Like a modern-day atheist, they argued that nothing exists that cannot be seen or measured. After all, don't we rely on physical evidence of something's existence before we believe it to be so? If someone said that the king shall never grow old or die, you might believe it, but in time you shall see that you are wrong. They argued that direct evidence is the source of philosophy and religion, and even the scriptures can be contradicted by direct evidence. In a strikingly modern argument, they said that humans are nothing more than their physicality. In the seed is all the information that produces the tree, the fruit, and leaves. Milk is produced by a physical process in the cow's gut, and mind and consciousness are just inbuilt qualities of humans, determined by their genes. Just as two sticks rubbed together produces fire, so the mind is just a byproduct of our brains. At this point, Bhishma dropped the whole pretense of a story. He states outright, "These skeptics, however, are in error." He said, "The animating force that enlivens a body departs it long before the body disintegrates, so this is evidence that something real must leave the body at the moment of death. If body and soul were the same, then the body should disappear at death, or the body should remain alive until it is completely disintegrated." Bhishma's next argument is fascinating. He said, "The world is too unfair and unequal for there not to be a soul." What he meant was that the only way you could explain the iniquities of life is by attributing each person's current circumstances to their past actions. Why else would one person be born rich and another poor, except that they are each reaping the fruits of their past life actions? He also used some subtle philosophical reasoning. He asked, how could a more refined system, like the mind, be the product of the less refined system of the brain? It sounds like he had been arguing with atheists so far. But now he turned his guns on doctrine that sounds like Buddhism to me. Bhishma said that the scholars in Janadev's court believed in rebirth, but that it was caused by ignorance, desire, and greed. They believed that ignorance is the vehicle which transports the karma from past lives into the next. Karma is the seed, and desire is what draws it into its next existence. Bhishma said, they believe that ignorance is ingrained in some way that survives the death of the body. When one life ends, another starts up immediately after. When that ignorance is dispelled by knowledge, the person is destroyed, or in other words, attains to nirvana. Bhishma just couldn't help but repeat himself. He said, this assertion is also erroneous. He asked a question that I have also wondered about. He said, when a creature dies and is reborn somewhere else with a different family and circumstances, then how is it that you could say there's any connection between them? Without a soul, the chain of reincarnational lives becomes a heap of disconnected links. And if it isn't you who suffers in the next life for your current sins, why would you care if your next stand-in pays dearly for what you do now? In addition, what would be the point in all our studying and religious practices if we were incapable of evolving over many lives in succession? Bhishma's biggest problem with this doctrine was that it relegated consciousness to the status of a mechanical byproduct of the brain. Having obliterated the arguments of the Buddhists to his satisfaction, Bhishma allowed the story to resume. When the debate finally ended, King Janadev asked for a full description of Panchasika's philosophy. The sage then delivered a long oration on the details of Shankhya, after which the king cast off his sorrows and lived happily ever after. There is no word of what happened to his court of refuted Buddhists, however. I must say that, by this point in the last teachings, the quality of the storytelling drops off drastically. I have skimmed over a large number of stories that were difficult to follow, yet ultimately led nowhere. Ironically, one of the better-told stories is yet another rendition of Daksha's sacrifice. This time it is presented much more like a divine soiree, or dinner party, than that strange science experiment that they described back in episode 83. This is now my number one candidate for most definitely being a later insertion, so we'll move on. Did you know that Vyasa had a son? Well, I for one did not, until now. Apparently Yudhishthira knew something of this, because he asked Bhishma to tell him about it. This strikes me as a bit odd, in that Vyasa isn't the one about to die, so why couldn't we get it directly from him? Besides, he's standing right there listening to them talk. The story begins at some indeterminate time in the past, on the slopes of Mount Meru. The summit of this mountain is known as one of Shiva's favorite hangouts, and so it was here that Vyasa camped out to do austerities in order to get himself a son. As he practiced some hardcore yoga, he prayed to Shiva that he might have a son who would be even more of a badass sadhu than himself. Vyasa stayed there for 100 years, eating nothing, his mind focused on the great god. The strength of his focus was such that it soon attracted a great host of rishis and angelic beings, all gathered to see what would happen next. Finally, Shiva himself was sufficiently gratified to make a personal experience. He stood, smiling before Vyasa, and said, "O island-born one, you shall have your son, and he shall indeed be pure as the elements. He shall be born with awareness of his unity with Brahma. He will be devoted to Brahma." Confident in Shiva's promise, Vyasa left Meru and resumed his regular life in the forest. One day, while rubbing his sticks to make a fire, he looked up and saw the lovely apsara called Gritachi. The cold, dead embers of his libido suddenly burst into flame. Although she flew away just moments later, she'd lit a fire that Vyasa could not put out. In consternation over his strange feelings, Vyasa tried to think of something else. He tried to distract his mind by working on getting the campfire started. He resumed rubbing his stick vigorously, and no, I did not make that up, and boom, without the aid of a woman, Vyasa produced a son, whom he named Sukha. The goddess of the river Ganga bathed this resplendent boy in her waters, and from the sky fell a stick and deerskin for his professional garb. Gods and Gandharvas sang his praises, and Shiva appeared with his consort to invest the boy with the sacred thread. Sukha was born knowing the Vedas, and Brihaspati became his teacher. When Sukha graduated from his studies, he stayed with his father and practiced severe austerities. Never once did he consider any other lifestyle, nor did he have any desire for the rewards of this world. The one desire that he still had was to get the hell out of here. He wanted to find emancipation as soon as he could. So he asked his father what he should do next on the fast track to salvation. Vyasa advised that the next thing he ought to do is pay a visit to the royal sponsor, King Janaka of Mithila. I'm guessing that this happened well before the time that the Buddhists invaded the king's court. This is the first that I've heard Vyasa had ties to other courts. It is also hard to reconcile how this story was more than a century in the making, while Vyasa should be about the same age or maybe a little older than Bhishma. Be that as it may, Vyasa also told his son to be sure to journey to the kingdom on foot. None of that fancy flying around or teleportation. Sukha was determined to tick all the boxes so he could finish up this incarnation. So he did as his father instructed and walked all the way to Mithila. When he arrived at the court, he was received with all honors, entertained and offered fine gifts. But Sukha wasn't interested in any of that. He just wanted to get on with his business with the king. The king met with Sukha, and the pair had a long discourse on the duties of Brahmins and how to gain enlightenment. As soon as his mission was completed, Sukha did not waste a moment. He literally blew out of there like the wind and returned to his home in the mountains. The boy returned to his father's ashram glowing with spiritual power. His feet did not appear to touch the ground when he walked. He bowed to his father and described to him what he learned at the king's court. The father and son team then settled down to chant the Vedas together. After some days of such chanting, Vyasa instructed his son to keep chanting while he went off to take a dip in the celestial Ganga River. Sukha did as he was told, but he also continued to consider his own destiny. He realized that none of the attractions of this world had succeeded in snaring his desires. His only goal remained salvation and nothing less. He watched the moon over many cycles as it waxed and waned, and he decided, "I have no wish to live in an existence where there are such changes. I am done with this body. I shall become all creatures." Having so decided, he spent one last day with his father and then left for the slopes of Mount Kailash. Sitting in meditation on the side of that famous mountain, he identified with the wind and then became the wind. He drifted up and shot away at the speed of thought. Like a meteor, he streaked through the sky, shedding his identity as he flew, finally striking a ridge that connected the mountains Himavat and Meru. The impact shattered the connection between these two mountaintops. The sound of this impact reached Vyasa's ears, and he sadly realized that his son was no more. In grief, he followed the path his son had taken, but he realized that while his son had left all desires, the father still remained. Shiva appeared to him and said, "Why are you so sad? Didn't you ask for a badass sadhu for a son?" It says that as a consolation, Shiva granted Vyasa access to a shadowy copy of his former son to keep him company. Bhishma's next story was about a descendant of Manu, a king called Duryodhana. This king had a daughter who ended up marrying the fire god Agni. Her son was called Sudarshana, and he was determined to find salvation by the way of the householder. Sudarshana married a princess named Ogavati, and the pair lived a modest family life at Kurukshetra. Sudarshana, committed to living the perfect dharma of a householder, instructed his wife to provide all possible hospitality for her guests. He said, "You should make no scruple about the means by which you welcome your guests, because there is no higher virtue than to provide hospitality." Ogavati, being an obedient and virtuous wife, said, "I shall do everything precisely as you say." Bhishma said that death, or Mrityu, took an interest in this son of Agni and decided to try to throw him off his course. One day, when Sudarshana had gone out to gather wood, an attractive young Brahmin appeared at his door. His wife Ogavati greeted him, gave him a seat and water to wash with, and asked what else she could do for him. The Brahmin said, "I am here for you. If you follow the rules of hospitality, then you may please me by giving yourself to me, right now." The good lady tried to convince him to take something else, but the Brahmin was adamant. Remembering the instructions she received from her husband, but feeling shameful for it, she said, "So be it," and she approached her guest. Meanwhile, Sudarshana returned with his load of wood. It says that Mrityu was with him like a constant companion as he returned home. When he reached his doorstep, he called for his wife, but he heard nothing. The otherwise chaste woman, overcome with shame, was unwilling to reply. As Sudarshana grew concerned, he heard the Brahmin's voice from inside the house. The Brahmin said, "You ought to know that I came here as a guest, and that your wife offered me many fine things, but all I desired was her body, and at the moment this fair lady is engaged in making me feel right at home." It says that Mrityu wanted to strike the impudent rake with his cudgel, but Sudarshana took charge. He said, "Very well, have a good time. I am greatly pleased, in fact. I have sworn to live the dharma of a householder, and so I freely give up anything requested by a guest of mine. So if this is what you desire, so be it." Then the Brahmin came out of the house and revealed himself to be the god Dharma. With an angelic chorus in the background, he congratulated Sudarshana. He said, "I came here to test you, and I am very well pleased with the results. And you should know that no one has the ability to insult the chaste lady, your wife, not to mention lay a hand on her. She is protected from defilement by your virtue and by her own chastity." He then elevated Ogavati into the goddess of the river by the same name. As for Sudarshana, he basically won the lottery. By having adhered to his dharma in such a spectacular way, he won emancipation and traveled to the regions of the blessed. In past episodes, we've heard many times about the special treatment Brahmins should be given. It seems that they could expect a life of luxury and do very little work if they so desired. It must have been good to be a Brahmin back then. Yudhishthira wanted to know what it takes for a lower caste person to acquire the status of a Brahmin. Bhishma said that it is impossible to change into a Brahmin. One can only be born a Brahmin. Brahmins are of the highest order, and it is only after living many lives among the lower orders and constant striving that one is permitted to be born a Brahmin. This brought to mind the story of a Brahmin of questionable birth named Matanga. When he was born, his father assumed he was legitimate, and the boy was duly raised as a bona fide Brahmin. Bhishma said that one day his father sent Matanga to fetch supplies for a sacrifice, so the boy set out on a cart pulled by a young donkey. This donkey was so young that she'd just been weaned. Thus, she did not follow his directions, and instead led the cart to her mother's side. Feeling ridiculous and annoyed, Matanga began to beat the donkey with his goad. The donkey's mother, who witnessed all of this, said to her daughter, "Don't feel too bad. That boy is no Brahmin like he pretends. He's just a low-caste scavenger." No Brahmin is capable of being so cruel and impatient. The Brahmin is the friend and counsel to all creatures, while this fellow is showing his real birth by his actions. Matanga heard this, so he jumped down and confronted the donkey. He said, "What's this? Are you questioning my descent? Are you suggesting something about my mother?" The donkey mama did not back down. She said, "You were begotten on your Brahmin mother by a horny Shudra barber. That makes you a Chandala. You are most definitely not a Brahmin." The boy believed her words, and in a state of shock, he returned home to his father. The old man asked about his supplies, and the boy said, "That donkey says I'm no Brahmin, so how can I help you with your sacred practices?" Instead, the boy committed himself to the most hardcore yoga and austerities. After doing this for some time, he managed to get Indra's attention. The god appeared to him and offered him a boon. The boy said, "I have only one desire from you, which is to become a real Brahmin. Give me that, and I'll stop these austerities and go home." Indra said, "You better think of something else that you want, because I just can't do that for you. This is simply not allowed, so ask for something else or give it up. There's no way that a Chandala can be turned into a Brahmin." Matanga did not give up. Instead, he turned it up a notch, spending 100 years standing on one foot. So once again, Indra appeared before him. He said, "I'm telling you, it ain't gonna happen, so don't even try. What you're asking for will surely destroy you. The rules are like this. By having been born to Chandala, you must live it for many lifetimes. After 1,000 years, you may graduate to be a Shudra. From there, you will work your way up. There are no shortcuts. You're looking at several hundreds of thousands of years before you can even hope to reach the priestly caste. And that is if you don't get distracted. And remember, if you should succumb to temptation or evil along the way, you may get booted down to the level of a scavenger again. So please, accept your status and ask for something else." Matanga persisted for another 1,000 years of penance, but still Indra refused. Finally, the false Brahmin broke down and asked for another boon. He said, "If you will not let me be Brahmin, then this is what I want. First, I want to be able to shapeshift into anything I want. I also want to be able to fly like Superman. And let me have whatever I want, whenever I want it. And I want everyone to bow down to me, especially Brahmins and Kshatriyas. So if you won't let me be a Brahmin, then that's what I want." Indra said, "Very well, you shall have all that." Shortly after Indra departed, Matanga died, and his spirit was transported to heaven where he could get his wish. Well, that's all for now. Next time, I'll try to wrap up these final teachings, and then we'll move on with the story. Thanks for listening.